trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a very windy day. You know, but we looked at the upcoming highs, and it's like in the 90s. It's like normal.
Yeah,
but we're actually what a little... is with this wind, Don? This, we haven't had that in a long time.
Well, we've had more of the air coming from the regions where monsoon conditions prevail. Yesterday, the day before, we had a lot of air pushing up over Northern California, further than normal, I guess we could say. So we were muggier once again a week later after our previous with high humidity event, another muggy day for by our standards. Humidity in the 40% range at the lowest end of the day when it's more typically in the mid-20s here. And high temperatures were uncomfortable because it was a little sticky by our standards. Well, that's all blowing away right now. Strong wind coming out of the south, southwest, so coming from that direction, but coming off the ocean. And so yesterday's high, close to 100 today. In fact, I think it was over 100 in some parts of the valley. Today, we're only going to be 87 degrees, today being July 22nd, as Lois and I are preparing the show for broadcast on July 23rd, 2026. The average high at this time of year would be 93 degrees. It is going to be 87 degrees today. Tomorrow, the day of the broadcast, will be 93 degrees, and Thursday night will be 58 degrees, completely clear and sunny throughout the forecast period. Friday will be 95 and sunny. Friday night, 59 and clear. Saturday, 95 and sunny. Saturday night, 61 and clear. And back to hot weather on Sunday with a temperature of 96 degrees for Davis. Sunday night will be a clear night at 61. Monday, 95 degrees. Monday night, 61. Tuesday, 94 degrees. Just slightly above average for the next few days. And we've been above, below. The main issue is the humidity that we've been having here, which is very uncommon in this area. And so our conversations, most of our conversations this time of year are about how watering is occurring, but we are having a few about fungus problems on the leaves, and particularly powdery mildew is showing up. Powdery mildew is a disease that can tolerate, indeed prefers, slightly lower moisture conditions than a lot of other fungus diseases. High humidity like we're having encourages it, but it doesn't. It wasn't high enough. It wasn't muggy enough to encourage downy mildew or a lot of the other fungus problems that you would have in a rainier summer climate. We had little spits of rain. It was overcast as we drove in the last couple of days. There were little bits of rain falling here and there. So fungus problems could be a concern, but the one we're seeing, we're talking to people about powdery mildew. That's a good one, easy one to discuss because you can rub it right off the leaf and show them that it's not actually in the leaf. It's actually just on the leaf. So you can literally wash that off. Interesting data point related to all of this. I saw a news story 3 days ago that wine grape harvest is beginning in Sonoma County. My reaction was the same as the person who wrote the story. July 19th, they're harvesting grapes in Sonoma County. That is way early. Indeed, it's the earliest ever. The earliest they've ever harvested wine grapes, I guess, in Sonoma County, according to the whatever the newspaper is over there. And they're harvesting because the sugar content is where it needs to be. They measure, you take a spectrophotometer when you're growing fruit, you check the sugar, the soluble solids content. It's where it needs to be, and they're harvesting. I'm reading between the lines on that a little bit. There's a lot of fungicides being applied around the valley right now in a lot of crops. And it wouldn't surprise me if they're also looking at the sugar content is there. The grapes are basically ready for harvest. The color is there. And we're having humid weather, which could lead to fungus problems on the fruit and possibly spoilage. I wouldn't be surprised if that played into their decision process. But also, with wine grapes, you're aiming for a particular sugar content. Sure, they could leave them on there in another 2, 3, 4 weeks and get higher sugar content, but that may not be their goal with the particular style of wine they're making. But earliest I've ever seen grape harvest, so I read that. Got home, walked out, checked my grapes. My blueberry variety grape is definitely ready for harvest, a good 3 to 4 weeks ahead of what it is normally considered to be ripe. Any of you growing table grapes, sample them. If they've colored up, you might be surprised to find that the sugar content is already there. Not that we've had higher temperatures or lower temperatures than average, just something about the way this year is going. They reach their sugar content ready for harvest early. In your garden, be aware of the possibility of leaf blight diseases on tomatoes because of the high humidity. If you see them, pick those leaves off or just trim that out. Powdery mildew on some plants. The first customer that I spoke with had it on his cucumber. Just rinse it off. That's fine. That's really all you need to do. We don't spray with fungicides for powdery mildew or anything like that, honestly. Just be aware of them. If it's a disease like mildew, you can rinse it off. All the other diseases, don't rinse them because it might spread the disease. So you got to know your disease before you apply this particular control
measure. And your thumb is the best tool to figure that out. Just rub it across that leaf and look at your thumb. What's on it?
Yeah, powdery mildew and rust are two that are really easy to diagnose in front of the customer. You just get to rub your thumb. If it's rust on the underside of the leaf, you've now got the color of Cheetos corn puffs all over your thumb. If it's powdery mildew, you've got this white stuff coming off, and you can show how it's coming off of the leaf. In the case of powdery mildew, you literally can rinse it off. And I'm finding that other than those muggy days, normal weather right now, this is a great time to rinse off your vegetable plants. We've got thrips out there. We've got spider mites building up a little bit because of dusty leaf conditions. And so every couple of days, especially when it's drier, maybe a north wind coming in, washing everything off really vigorously is a really simple pest management strategy. So I think that the more of you that can do that in our climate, I know there's people listening in places where it's moist in the summer, where it rains in the summer. You'll have to adopt your own practices based on your own local climate conditions. But here in the Valley, interior Southern California as well, East Bay, places where it's typically very low humidity, washing the plants off is a really good practice. That's why we mention it all the time for pest control at our nursery and on the air. One of the simplest things you can do, get a nozzle you're comfortable with that makes a pretty forceful blast. I don't mean a necessarily a fire hose type of thing. That's what you do for scale or mealy bugs. But I'm just talking about rinsing the leaves to reduce thrips, to reduce spider mites, to reduce aphids if they're present, to knock down white flies, and to clean off things like powdery mildew. Get out there and rinse the garden. It's good for the beneficials as well. You know what? This is a great thing to train eight-year-olds. How to rinse the vegetable garden. Get them their own nozzle. Show them how to do it carefully. That's a fantastic job. Opportunity for the young person in your household.
And then they can turn it on you too.
Yeah. We have announcements. What do we got there? You got a master gardener's thing.
Okay. Yeah, Kevin Marini is going to do a best practices of great gardeners. So that's the presenter. It's August 13th. It's at one of those Thursday Zoom programs.
UCANR.edu, site we like to send you to all the time. Just look for UC Master Gardener Program of Yolo County. Best practices of great gardeners, August 13, 2026. It's a great description of the event there. And when you click on view event, there's the Zoom link. And it's the same Zoom link for all of these Zoom meetings. Mark your calendar now. We'll get you more information as this comes closer. But this is a big deal in our side of the valley. Hose Down Harvest Festival, Saturday, October 3rd at Full Belly Farm. You can go to eco-farm.org/hose-down. But we'll remind you, Hose Down Harvest Festival. I just want to give you a chance to mark your calendar. Saturday, October 3rd, 2026 at Full Belly Farm.
So there's a question. If you're filling a large planter, or you're going to make a raised bed or a pot or whatever, is it better to buy bulk soil or bagged goods? Or maybe save by buying cheaper bagged goods? And Don's answer, which I thought was wonderful, is I would honestly rather have you fill the bed much of the way with topsoil from a rock yard and then top it off with high quality bagged product than buy cheap bagged goods. Why?
With the cheap bagged goods, you really have no idea what you're getting. There is no standardization. There's no regulation of things sold in bags to consumers, except for two words, organic and compost. Those words are regulated. If that word is on there, organic means that it meets certified organic input materials, or it's OMRI certified or something. So it means it's literally can be used in organic production. Compost literally means that it has been brought to a particular internal temperature, which is validated, documented, and that information is provided to the state of California so they can put the word compost on there. So organic and compost are regulated terms. Beyond that, it can say anything. What is a planting mix? What is a planting soil? Why does it even say soil when there's no soil in there at all? Why do we call something potting soil when it literally has no soil in it? So these are the problems with bagged goods. And Can you think about why a soil amendment, I'll call it that, would cost $20 from one company and six from another company, and it's not the same product? Why, what would the difference be?
How good is it?
Yeah, and how do we define
it? You get good? What you pay for is really the way I would go when talking about things in bags.
Yes, and a lot of it is byproducts. The base of a lot of these materials are byproducts of other industries. So in California, for example, or up in the Pacific Northwest, the starting point is fir bark, which is just a byproduct of the lumber industry. It's the bark part that's stripped off and also the other stuff that they don't use after they make lumber. And they grind it to a certain size and they compost it for a while, but not long enough to officially call it compost. And that becomes the base of a lot of potting soils and planting mixes and soil amendments out here in California. My understanding, of course, if you're up in Canada or places near there, probably peat moss is a significant percentage because up there it's a lot cheaper than it is here. If you're in the southeastern United States, my understanding is pine bark fines, as they, I guess, call them, where they take pine as your lumber species. The bark is stripped off prior to turning it into lumber. And then that is ground up and used as the base. It really depends on where you are as to what they're going to use. And I remember years in which one of our bag goods suppliers was using mushroom compost because they were from the Salinas area. That's where all the mushrooms in basically the world are grown for the grocery stores. And they have a whole bunch of this compost that they use and they have to put in fresh every crop. And so this particular bag goods supplier just tapped into that and started using mushrooms. Compost. It doesn't make that much difference what it is. You just need to know the characteristics of it. But if your bag of stuff is cheap, that's pretty much all it is something like that. One of those things, sawdust, basically, hopefully composted a little bit. Because the things that are expensive in bag goods are the organic fertilizers they've added, the peat moss, if they've added peat moss, or coir. Neither of those are from anywhere near here. So peat moss is all coming from Canada and coir is coming from the Indian Ocean. They're a long way away, so they're going to be relatively expensive. And they'll add sand for various reasons, and sometimes pumice and lava rock. Each of those is relatively expensive, except for the sand. So adding pumice or lava rock to make it a specialty soil, that adds cost. If you're just buying a bag of cheap stuff, you're buying a bag of composted sawdust, in my opinion. That's not the best thing to be putting in your garden, not even the best thing necessarily to be putting on your garden. You do get what you pay for. I would much rather have someone go to the rock yard. Locally, there's three of them, one in Westsac, one in Woodland, one in Davis, which will sell you topsoil. They'll blend it with compost, whatever they're calling compost, if you want something more gardeny. And that's fine. Those are a good starting point to fill your box with. We're assuming you have a big planter box. It's just not economical to buy it by the bag. So that's why you're asking this question in the first place. Fill it 3/4 of the way up with that topsoil that you bought. Ask if you can get a soil analysis, the soil test that was done on that, so you know if it's got any pH issues or nutrient deficiencies. But you'll correct those immediately by topping it with the good expensive stuff that you buy from a nursery like mine or the local hardware store. Normal, high-end, good quality potting soil or something that's got
bagged
manure, compost, organic fertilizers, a bunch of stuff in there. And they're adding all kinds of really good organic fertilizers. So that'll take care of the problem you're going to have with the topsoil, which is that it won't have nutrients in it. And it probably won't retain water real well. So you need to correct that part by adding something that contains nitrogen, some source, manure or organic fertilizer or both, and something that retains moisture. So preferably a peat, coir, good quality compost, that kind of thing. That's why you buy the good stuff for the top part. And then every season, and we have two full seasons here, every season that you plant, you top dress with more of the good quality stuff that has the organic fertilizer in it and helps to retain moisture.
When you're making this the first time, you've got the rock yard soil 3/4 the way up, and then I'll put some bags on there. How deep would, let's say it's a 2 foot tall bed, how deep would you need to make those, that bagged top layer?
I always figured 2 inches is kind of the minimum. More than that is fine. It's the most costly part of this whole process. So it'll be your pocketbook will be what ultimately determines it. But I think 2 inches is a good starting point, bearing in mind, it's going to break down and settle.
Okay. So I'm making this bed. I put the stuff in, I put the 2 inches. Now I've got a layer between the rock yard soil and the topsoil. Don't I have to turn that in a little bit so that it's not such a harsh layer?
Yeah, I wonder if people who listen to the old versions of the show go back the 20 years to when I would describe this process, which is that the first thing you should do, this is what we used to recommend, it actually works really well, dig the soil at the bottom where you're putting this thing in, this raised planter, and mix, turn that soil. And then take this topsoil that you just got in, dump 6 inches on there and turn that in. And then dump in and turn that in. And then the stuff that goes on top that I'm talking about, turn that into the very top at least. And the idea there was to at least have a gradient from top to bottom, mm-hmm. so that the roots would happily penetrate through and go out the bottom into your native soil where they would be truly happy. You don't have to do that.
The roots, our soil is pretty good.
The roots will work it out. You know, this is what I've found. Roots solve a lot of problems.
Let's put it this way. I had a half barrel sitting in my driveway. I didn't realize it was on the crack between the two slabs of the driveway.
The expansion joint.
And,
yeah.
And those roots were so happy underneath the concrete. I mean, it's like it did really well, and I wasn't watering it all that
much. I wonder why it's doing so well.
Yeah. It got to be like 13 feet tall, and I gave it to somebody, and they came over to get it, and they couldn't move the pot. They had to chisel off the roots to take it home. And, you know, that's a lot of stress for a little plant like that, but they did really well. They planted it, they took it home, they planted it, the roots recovered, put out new roots, and it was perfectly happy.
We can make use of roots actually to create soil for us. So even though I no longer say you have to blend all this stuff together and try to create this wonderful gradient, the aggressive roots of a deep-rooted plant like a tomato, or the extremely aggressive roots of any grass plant, grasses have vigorous aggressive roots that will colonize soil areas quite readily. They'll just go through that. And then when you cut that plant down at the end of the season, remember, we don't pull them out, we cut them down, those roots will disintegrate, and you've immediately created an amended soil by so doing.
And so you've got channels for water
too. Yeah, macro pores, and we can use cover crops for the same purpose. I had a really good example of this on my own property where I used a tarp to kill the winter weeds in one area, and the other area was just grasses. It was solid oats, basically, so I left them because I happened to use them as a cover crop. Those I just mowed, let the tops die down, mowed them again, dug and planted. The area where the tarp had been since 1st of March, and we're talking about late April, early May, was bare. The weeds had been killed by the tarp, and the soil was hard. The soil, I had to break it up, even though it was the same basic moisture status as the soil nearby with grass roots. It was hard. It was chunky. I had to spend a little time breaking it down, getting it back into a nice garden soil. So roots are really, really helpful. Roots are your colonizers and your cultivators, and they make macro pores, and they blend all those soil types, and they will help the movement of water and nutrients down, nutrients up. There's some work, not work, some ideas in permaculture that you'll plant certain plants for their deep-rooted character so they'll pull nutrients up from very deep. Every now and then people come in and ask me for comfrey for this purpose. It seems to be mentioned in a lot of permaculture publications. Very deep-rooted, therefore it'll bring up zinc and whatever else for, you know, the plants that are higher up that will somehow, it will somehow benefit them by doing this. I'm sure that's probably true. I don't know if I'd plant comfrey for that purpose, but bearing that in mind, the roots are going down. They're getting through there. They can even get through surprisingly hard soil in the case of the vigorous plants, especially the ones that we use as cover crops. So roots can solve a lot of these problems with evening things out. Cover crops can help you get nitrogen in there and help you get more organic material in there. Top dressing each season with 2 to 4 more inches of the good stuff can take that mineral base that you started with, the topsoil itself, and create a wonderful soil over time. We went through a process about 2 to 3 years after the pandemic. A lot of people had jumped into vegetable gardening. They were buying those raised planters you see online, or they were getting livestock troughs or whatever. In the case of the raised planters, it's just a thing sitting on dirt. And everything would go fine for the first year. Then the second year, things weren't growing as well. And the third year, plants were just barely performing. So you are seeing the effects of loss of nitrogen. So you need to keep supplementing that. And then, of course, making it easier for yourself to water. If you just mulch with something that has some nitrogen and lots of organic stuff, and you do that every spring and every fall, you can take topsoil and turn it into good garden soil.
Okay. Those are pretty joyful discussions. Now, I'm afraid, Don, that I'm gonna bring us a downer.
Okay.
It's an article that he sent me, and it's called The Bugs of Summer.
Yeah, we should make a movie of this, The Bugs of Summer.
No, really. I mean, come on, not with the movie, not with pictures and everything. I mean, these things are awful looking.
These are okay. My mother thought bugs were cool, and that's fortunate. So I grew up with an attitude in the household of bugs are just as good to have in your garden as plants. If they're harming the plants, all bets are off. She was more than happy to adopt directly physically lethal approaches to them. But the first thing she would do when she would see anything, insect, unique spider, whatever, in San Diego, we had scorpions, tarantulas, you name it, is either catch it or at least get close to it so we can figure out what it was. So that's what we want you all to do. Because a lot of the bugs that people see and bring in pictures of and so on are not anything to be concerned about. Leatherwing beetles are out right now feeding on your aphids. The larvae of lacewings are out feeding on aphids. The larvae and the adults of ladybird beetles are out there. And nobody recognizes the larvae typically of ladybugs as being something beneficial. But as we get into July and August, we get stink bugs of various types. In particular, harlequin bugs, leaf-footed bugs, which are year-round, and various forms of what are directly called stink bugs, such as the relatively new one in our area, the brown marmorated stink bug, and a number of other types of stink bugs that we already had here before it arrived. The harlequin bug
looks like a ladybug whose markings have been sort of swirled up a little bit.
Yeah.
So if you actually just see that at a glance, wouldn't you think that was a ladybug?
You might. And there are ladybird beetles, which is technically they're beetles, not bugs, but we can go ahead and call them ladybugs since that's the common name. They are, of course, voracious aphid feeders. They don't all have the exact same black spots on red body that we're familiar with. That's the convergent ladybird beetle, which is our native one in this area. And even that one doesn't have the same markings all the time. There's a lot of really interesting ladybugs out there. A lot of them that are in your yard that you wouldn't necessarily recognize as a ladybug. If you've ever had the scale that gets on citrus occasionally, the cottony cushion scale, there is a ladybird beetle, a ladybug. It's about a quarter the size of a regular ladybug that was introduced specifically to feed on that scale as a very successful biological control measure. It doesn't look to you or me like a ladybug. The shape is right. The layout, the outline is right. The color is different and it's much smaller, but it's a type of ladybug. And that's feeding very specifically on cottony cushion scale on lemons and hardenbergias and things like that. Once that scale came in, it was one of the very first, very successful biological control programs was finding a type of ladybug that would actually feed specifically on it. So it's a big group, but the one everybody knows, our familiar, friendly, native, convergent ladybird beetle, lives in the Coast Range, massive convergences, migrates through the valley to the other side, migrates back, and is clearly also resident here in the valley year-round. That's the common one with distinct black spots on an orange-red body. This looks kind of like that, except they aren't as spots. They're more like weird angular patterns. And when they're small, of course, you know, unless your eyes are really good, it's pretty hard to tell them apart. Someone sent me a picture of some that had just hatched out. They tend to have groups of eggs that are close together, fairly neatly lined up, and they all hatch at once, which is a typical pattern of a lot of insects. The whole egg mass will hatch together. And so they start fanning out from there. And it can be a little freaky to go out and find on one plant a whole bunch of these in one place. This one is a sucking insect. Harlequin bugs don't chew holes. So if you see them and you see a hole, they didn't do it. Okay, don't blame them.
Blame the dog. No.
Blame the katydids, the grasshoppers, the snails, the slugs, the caterpillars. Those are all things that chew holes. These are sucking insects. They're not generally a big problem for us except on coal crops, brassicas. And they're not that big a problem on brassicas because they aren't that active in cold weather here typically. But if you happen to be one of those people that wants to have collards in your garden year-round, you will probably have harlequin bugs in your garden year round because you carry them through the summer on the plants that you allowed to go on from spring into summer and that then went into the fall when you perhaps plant new ones nearby and they move from the old ones to the new ones. Mm-hmm. Common problem for folks like me out in the country is they live on mustard. Loads of mustard everywhere you are in agricultural areas in California. There's plenty of it on my farm. I mow it as fast as I can. But especially if you're going to be planting a fall vegetable garden with some of the early brassicas, which will be happening in July, August, the very first of them, Brussels sprouts start to go in, or the long season cauliflowers or things like that. Get all the other mustard family members out of there now mow them off. That'll do it. That'll take care of it. Mow them off, either that or pull them out, whatever is easier for you, because that will keep you from having an over-summering population of harlequin bugs to start this new cycle that's beginning, at least in this customer's yard, and will start to infest his cauliflower and his broccoli and his collards as we get into the season.
Do the harlequin bugs have to have something to live on all summer, or don't they just hibernate or something?
They don't hibernate, and so they would need a host plant. That's the thing. They need something to live on to keep the population going. Yes, I'm sure some of them, I'll find these, by the way, on woody plants nearby. They like blackberries. I have no shortage of those on my property. They can do a little damage to them, but more to the point, that's this part of one of the places they'll often come off of. They come in from weedy areas on the edges of sloughs and creeks and farms and irrigation ditches, and they move in back into your garden. Mostly, you just see like little blotches on the leaves. If there's been very heavy feeding on something like collards or cauliflower, you'll see blotches on the leaves. They can get to the point where they, if you get large numbers of them, where they'll actually kill the plants. So the key is to just destroy these old brassicas before the start of the new season. And brassicas includes mustards. The one flowering plant I can think of, I wouldn't pull them all out, but I'd keep an eye on them as a possible host source, is Sweet Alyssum, which is in that family and, of course, is a year-round flower in our area. So if you happen to be planting your brassicas and you got a bunch of Sweet Alyssum blooming, check it out first to make sure there aren't harlequin bugs in there. Or you know what? Mow it. It'll come back. You're not going to hurt your Sweet Alyssum that way. There are insecticides. If you go online, you'll find information about it. But as they say at the IPM site, and I agree with this, insecticides are generally not recommended in gardens for stink bugs or harlequin bugs. They don't work that well. You'd be using a broad spectrum insecticide that'll kill other, including beneficial insects. And honestly, they don't typically do that much harm. So that's harlequin bugs. But be aware of them as something that can move on to your brassicas as you plant them, and also something that you can take action midsummer to prevent having a problem in the fall and winter.
And these are a type of stink bug, right?
Right. Term refers to the fact that if you squish it, you'll know exactly where the term came from.
What about those leaf-footed bugs? Those are stink bugs, aren't they?
They're called stink bugs as well, and they're related. They're a native insect here. I think we have three species that are native in the valley, and they very happily moved on to these wonderful agricultural crops that we brought in when we all moved here, and they think it's great that there's these almonds and pomegranates and things like that. Wonderful. They are in this area. We typically find them out in the winter weeds and grasses, and especially the weeds. You mow them, they tend to move into the garden. You have two or three generations. The late season one is the one that seems to bother people the most, be late summer, because you start to get a lot of nymphs and adults clustering together as the nights get colder. They form aggregations. They overwinter in aggregations, but more to the point, you're out there in October, November, you're looking at your pomegranates, and I have a picture that I show when I give talks on this, taken by one of my staff people, a single pomegranate with at least 50 leaf-footed bugs crowding all over the fruit, trying to poke their proboscis into it. They're strong proboscis. They can poke them into an almond as it's developing and liquefy the nut and drink it out. They can poke it into a pomegranate, suck the juice out of the arrow. The only thing you're going to notice, other than 50 or so on one fruit, which really grossed her out, is as you open that fruit, there's a possibility there'll be some dry, desiccated arils. That's the little red part of the pomegranate, the juicy part. All the rest of them are fine. Those actually got drained by a leaf-footed bug. And sometimes they introduce rot organisms when they poke in there. So you'll open up a pomegranate and it's spoiled on the inside. As she noted, there are at least 50 more pomegranates on that tree. They weren't covered with leaf-footed bugs, so they're all in one place because they do tend to aggregate that way. They're slow moving and stupid. You seriously can take a bucket of water. Sure, put some soap in it if you want, and hold it underneath that pomegranate or wherever you find them, and just scrape them into it. Just shake the thing, and they will fall in, and they will drown. So it's very easy to kill them. I've also heard of people vacuuming them up with either a shop vac on a very long extension cord or a handheld vacuum cleaner, and be sure to cover that over before you just set it out in your garage, because they'll crawl right back out. So they will die in there, or you put it in the trash. Any of those things will work. It's pretty easy to control them mechanically. They don't do that much damage, but they're freaky looking. So they probably answer more questions about this one large insect than any other visible large insects around the area, because they're so common and sometimes form very large aggregations. Populations after mild winters will have higher survival rates, so you may find more of them in the spring. They really like thistles. So if you're in a rural property and you've got thistles on the edge of your property, please mow them anyway, and this would help to reduce that problem. They do feed on almonds and pistachios and pomegranates. Feeding on leaves and shoots is usually doesn't even cause visual damage. You aren't even aware of it, though it is occurring. And on tomatoes, you will sometimes see some fruit injury. Picture that was sent to me, I'm pretty sure it was the other kind of stink bug, of fruit that had been obviously fed on when it was still green in the division stage, not the expansion stage, very lumpy and gross looking. If they feed on tomatoes that have expanded, you might see a slight discoloration. Probably you've never noticed this before. Nothing to worry about particularly. Any damage is tolerable. Any damage to landscape plants is negligible. They overwinter in wood piles, or in the bark inside that pomegranate that's hanging on the tree. Keeping weeds mowed in the winter is helpful, but there's not that much you really need to do about them here. In a healthy garden, you typically don't have an issue with them. And so I don't really think there's any need to spray for leaf-footed bugs or stink bugs. It's the same basic issue that we get a lot of calls. Early fall, nights are getting colder, days are getting shorter. They'll be on the west-facing light-colored wall of your building. Like 50 or 100 of them, because it's warm at the end of the day there. They're just there waiting to spend the night on a warmer spot. Makes it easy to vacuum them up if you choose to do that. Again, stink bugs don't do a lot of damage. They don't bite people. They don't make holes in plants or anything like that. And in general, they don't cause enough damage in the vegetable garden or the fruit garden to be of any concern in our area. When the brown marmorated stink bug came into California, we were very concerned because it had a huge host range. And we thought this is going to be a big problem. But it turns out, we don't have the kind of unbroken canopy of deciduous hardwood trees that they really need to build up in large numbers as they did back east. It's here. It's been here for 15 years. Occasionally, people report it to me. It's not building up in those numbers. The first places they established, the brown marmorated stink bug were established, was in sort of downtown Sac, following the lines where there are much older trees with a solid canopy. And even there, it's just more like freak phenomena. Someone took a picture of hundreds of them clustering on the trunk of a tree. Not doing any damage, just hundreds of them clustering on the trunk of a tree. Wanted to know whether she needed to do anything about it. Well, not really.
You could put a blanket on and keep more. I mean, that's why they cuddle together.
Right. They're trying to get warm. There you go. Make a little house for the brown marmorated stink bugs. And then as over time, we realize, okay, this is just another insect that's part of the background here, not a major pest. But if you do encounter them, soapy water in a bucket or a vacuum cleaner may be your best bet.
It is July, and I have the calendar in front of me. And I'm not going to do them all because we don't have time to do them all. But I want to talk about the Shasta daisy, which is one of the things you have pictures of. The Shasta daisy blooms forever, doesn't it?
Well, they start blooming May to June, and they bloom right on through the summer. They're one of the late summer daisies. That late summer is daisy time, as far as I'm concerned. Gaillardias are blooming. Rudbeckias are blooming. These are all colorful daisies. Shasta daisy was invented by Luther Burbank. He created it, literally, interspecific hybridization. So it's sterile. It doesn't set seed. So it just blooms its heart out all season long. And original Shasta daisies were great, big, tall plants that would be floppy. They were one of those things, like chrysanthemums, which they're related to. The bloom spikes were 3 feet plus and would just fall on the ground unless you caged them or staked them. Of course, most people were cutting them to bring them indoors as cut flowers. But as garden plants, they were ungainly. If you look at nurseries nowadays, you'll find a lot of Shasta daisies that are, one, more heavily double flowers, like really double, like almost chrysanthemum-like, and others that look just like the old-fashioned Shasta daisy, but are short plants. A number came out a few years ago that were in the 18 to 24-inch range when they were in bloom, which is great, because then the plant will be freestanding, holds the blooms up, and doesn't require staking, makes a great garden plant. There's even a new one. It's only 4 inches tall and has 3-inch blooms on it. So it's a ground cover form of Shasta daisy.
So you said that these are sterile, so they don't recede.
Correct.
How in the world are you getting new plants? How are you getting things that are shorter or wider? How's that happening if there's no seeds?
You recreate that same hybrid over and over again.
Oh.
Just like triploid plants, marigolds. Marigolds were the most popular flowering bedding plant 100 plus years ago. The problem was they would set seed and they'd look rough and you'd have to deadhead them all the time. Well, David Burpee's father, actually, I believe it was, hybridized African and French marigolds, two different species. When you do interspecific hybrids, the progeny, if they work at all, that's usually the sticking point, that usually it's hard to hybridize between species, the progeny are often sterile. And in the case of marigolds, they're triploid. They're like a mule. They are not able to reproduce on their own. But as long as you keep crossing those parents, you'll get the seed that you need. And in the case of Shasta daisies, you have a perennial that can also be propagated vegetatively. So once you've created a new one, you can then just multiply it out vegetatively by cuttings or divisions, or a tissue culture is sometimes done with some of these if you need large numbers more quickly. So essentially, the sterile plant is created and then multiplied either vegetatively or by recreating the hybrid parent lines, recrossing the hybrid parent lines. The big advantage of triploid marigolds, for example, not only did you not have to deadhead them so they didn't look ungainly because of seed heads forming, because seed heads didn't form, they'd keep blooming. So they would bloom like crazy. They'd bloom right up till frost, and they became extremely popular and kind of took over the market. So when they can do a triploid hybrid, which is how you get seedless watermelons, for example, when you can do that by recreating it from the same parent lines, that's the simple way to do it with an annual. With a perennial, you create it, you have your clone, and you now clone it out by the zillions and billions in order to sell the exact same plant.
Okay. I think we'll leave most of these for another time, but I did want to talk about Agapanthus. That's another one that used to be big and now it's short, and it used to be one color, that sort of medium lavender blue, and now there's multiple colors. Are Agapanthus still popular?
They're popular again. They went out of favor for a while. When I first got into gardening, every landscape had Agapanthus in them. It's a plant from South Africa. South Africa's climate is very similar to California's. And you were right. There were four choices: blue and white, tall and short. Take your pick. Do you want blue, tall or short? Do you want white, tall or short? That was it. And there were a couple of short versus just one. There was Queen Anne and there was Peter Pan. So ordering as a nursery guy in the 1980s, I would order in, you know, the mix of those choices. It got to the point where it was such a common plant. It was so abused. I mean, they'd put them into landscapes that weren't going to be irrigated. That isn't great. They can tolerate it, but they don't bloom very well. They put them in the shade, they wouldn't bloom very well. They would need deadheading or else they'd reseed all over the place.
They reseed all over the place, and you can give them to your neighbors.
In your yard, yes. Fortunately, it's not a plant that has, it seemed like it had the potential to become regionally invasive, but that hasn't occurred, thank goodness, because they're everywhere. I remember someone jokingly asking us in the 1980s, is there like some zoning code that requires there to be Agapanthus in every lot? Because every yard had Agapanthus, India hawthorn, photinia hedges, you know, the same basic landscape plants. So they became so common as to be pedestrian and people stopped using them. Some astute breeders observed that there were other species. These were all either Agapanthus africanus or Agapanthus orientalis. There were other species in South Africa that had advantages, like flowers that hang instead of holding upright, flowers that are vivid dark purple. Some of them were deciduous. Agapanthus in general are evergreen. Some were deciduous. That might be desirable in some design situations. So they began hybridizing mainly for less seed production and longer bloom, which is a great advantage, and more intense colors. And there are some very, very dramatic colors of Agapanthus now, all in the blue-white choice. We don't have red, pink, yellow, anything else. But there are shades of purple to the point of being very, very dark purple. There's some white ones that have blue throats that really pop because of that bicolor combination, and so on. And some of them that just keep blooming. There's the strangely named ones. I won't even give you the names. Just ask for the ones that keep blooming, that will initiate blooms in April, as all Agapanthus do, bloom in May, and then keep initiating blooms in June and July and August and bloom all summer long. So you now have Agapanthus that bloom over much of the growing season. And they're just as easy to grow. They're just as tough. This is definitely a California plant. If you're in a much colder climate, they don't go below, let's see what the old Western Garden book says for Agapanthus cold tolerance. I know they're actually grown, like, you know, in pots.
Well, and they tolerated our 90s.
Heat is no problem. Yeah. So they go down to
1990s when we had that freeze.
Oh, yes. Yeah. They came through that with no problem. Sunset zone 7 is the coldest they go, 8 through 9, 12 through 24. So mostly Bay Area, Southern California, and the Valley, and they can tolerate down into the 20s. Below that, you get into USDA zones 8 and colder. You're going to grow this as an indoor-outdoor plant, which is hard for us in California to imagine. But, you know, if I lived in one of those places, I'd probably do that because the bloom is amazing. You know what really loves them, aside from hummingbirds, is swallowtail butterflies. Absolutely cool. Love the flowers of Agapanthus. So if you're trying to draw swallowtails into your garden, a nice big clump of a long-season blooming Agapanthus can be added to your border. You don't have to feel embarrassed. You have such a pedestrian plant from the 1960s. It's retro. Okay.
And you can put it in a big pot by your front door on concrete so that the seeds won't pop up. And
I wouldn't, first of all, I wouldn't worry about the seeds on these new hybrids. That's the first thing. They don't seed like the old ones. Second, in a pot is okay, but man, these have thick, fleshy roots. And they're gonna bulge that pot out and break it if they have to get out of it. So they are fine in containers as long as you choose one that they can, big enough that they can grow into it. And I realize in about 3 to 5 years, you're gonna have a rather major repotting or dividing or just giving up.
Well, if they don't reseed, just put them in the ground.
Yeah. Yeah, but they're great in containers. They make a lovely container plant, very classic looking and urn.
You wrote an article when we very first made this website, and it's called "There's Brown Spots in My Lawn." And as soon as I saw that, I thought, "Yep, you got a dog."
Well, that is certainly one possible cause of brown spots in the lawn. It was one of the very first articles that we put up on the brand new website when Lois originally created it with me in 1998. And brown spots in your lawn were one of the most common things we talked with people about at that time.
The three big things that he listed in this article were drought, pets, and heat burn. Now, drought, of course, is you're not watering well enough. Pets, you got a female dog and you're making spots in the lawn. Urine is very high in nitrogen. So the part that doesn't die in the middle actually grows up much better. So you end up with these rings of bright green and then the dead stuff. And, yep. And then heat burn is where somebody threw something down on a sunny day. So maybe somebody left the Frisbee out or.
I used to go out and look at these lawns when these problems would occur because they would go to their reference books and they would think that they had either an insect problem or a fungus problem. And typically the first thing we would rule out was the three that Lois just went through there: drought, pets, and heat burn. Pets are pretty straight. That's a challenging one to deal with because your dog is going to go out there and do that again, probably every day, unless you have another place for the dog to go to the bathroom. And no, male dogs typically go and pee on bushes. Female dogs go and pee on the lawn. That's why we mentioned the gender of the dog. It does make a difference in how they behave. Some male dogs do squat. And in the case of urine, it's just a short-term thing, but it can cause a pretty unsightly appearance. I will never forget the customer who had a little Yorkie thing. And she would let the Yorkie thing out to pee on the lawn at 7 because she knew the sprinklers would come on at 7:30.
Oh, that's smart. Take care of because then the water would dilute the urine.
And it worked, apparently, as far as I know, that worked. So toxicity is a function of concentration as it happens. So if you can dilute it, as the old saying is, the solution to pollution is dilution. So if your pollution is coming from the dog, dilute it right away. Or just try to figure out an area that's maybe a little more informal, because what she had was a very picture-perfect lawn. This was the problem. Nice. Low
to let him out in the backyard.
Ryegrass, bluegrass lawn, had to keep it up to standards for the neighbors kind of thing. This was just making these unsightly spots. If you have a more informal lawn that's mowed maybe 4 inches high, 3 to 4 inches is great if you can do that in the summer. If it's a tall fescue, you're not going to notice this as much anyway. It was more of a problem with the rye bluegrass combinations that people did in those days. But diluting it is the one thing you can possibly do or change your nature of your turf. Drought is a pretty easy one to recognize because drought is, it follows the sprinkler pattern problem. I mean, you can look, when I would go out and show people, I would say, look, you've got a ring of healthy area and it's less colored, you know, less deep green as you go in a curve around that. Clearly your distribution of your sprinkler heads is not adequate, or the edges along the sidewalk, the edges on the driveway are going to dry out faster. Technically the ET rate in those little micro areas is higher because of the high temperature and the fact that it's reflected heat. That part is going to just need more water most likely. That's a fairly easy thing to correct as long as you don't mind doing a little hand watering, or perhaps just run your sprinklers longer is going to be a common answer to that problem.
And then we have insects. Now, yeah. Insects, I don't really see too many in our lawns here compared to back east.
Not anymore. This is a big change. So when we first opened in 1981, majority of lawns were a blend of perennial ryegrass and bluegrass because they were beautiful. That's a great combination. It is the shiny green of the ryegrass and especially the dark green of the Kentucky bluegrass. The fact that you can mow it to 1 inch to 1.5 inches and have a turf for doing special sporting things on. And that was the lawn standard across much of the United States, even in areas where it wasn't really those weren't really suited grass species. Bluegrass grows great in Kentucky, where it's from, Kentucky bluegrass, or Oregon, or places like that, where you relatively mild weather, even in the summer when it's hot, it's not dry hot like here, and they do fine. That's your standard of turf, and that's what every new type of turf that comes along and every new variety is compared to is Kentucky bluegrass for its appearance. But it's also not heat tolerant, thins out badly when you mow it short during hot weather, and is really susceptible to fungus problems. People who had Kentucky bluegrass lawns would be coming into my nursery every couple of weeks to buy another thing of fungicide. I had one guy who had a 5,000 square foot Kentucky bluegrass lawn in South Davis. It was beautiful. He should have been in advertising for Scott's Lawn Care products. I mean, it was utterly perfect. And he got fungus, Fusarium blight, every year. And he wanted to buy two or three bottles of Benamil fungicide every summer and spent all summer spraying to keep this problem from coming back and spreading. Most of my customers nowadays don't want to do that. Thank goodness. They don't really want to put all kinds of insecticides and fungicides and things like that on their turf. And so gradually, as we've had more droughts, as people have gotten accustomed to the effect of drought on their lawn, they've shifted over to the fescues. Fescue grasses are great for the valley. They're great for many of the drier parts of the United States. They're more deep-rooted typically. They're more tolerant of drought. They're less prone to fungus. And when they get insect pests, you hardly notice the damage. So the tall fescues came on first. Your typical city park is tall fescue. You've probably seen those wider blade grasses. They mow them 3 to 4 inches high. It'll be a mix of species, but typically it's dominated by the tall fescue. They're coarse looking. Some people get a skin reaction to them. Some people do find they cause dermatitis. So they're not as popular for backyards. But after the tall fescues came along, the dwarf fescues came along, which are just dwarf versions of tall fescues. It's just shorter, slower growing versions of tall fescue. Those have become very, very popular. Your typical new subdivision where they plant a tree and roll out a lawn, it's going to be one of these dwarf fescue sod blends. Typically, they do add 5 to 10% bluegrass to that, even though, as I've mentioned, it's not great for this area because it knits the sod together and gives it a good color. The pattern, typically, you plant these dwarf fescue lawns that are 90% dwarf fescue. And over the next 3 to 5 years, that Kentucky bluegrass that's in there, 10%, will get fungus and die out. And I get those calls and people show me pictures and I go, yeah, that there is the bluegrass dying. Notice the fescue is fine. Don't worry about it. Your lawn is transitioning as it should. The sod was held together nicely. It looked great. Now just keep seeding in the dwarf fescue. We'll get you the right grass seed this fall, seed it in. Everything will be fine. Some people still don't like these dwarf fescues because they do cause some dermatitis, and they're, again, a wider blade than is considered optimal. So we've gone over to fine fescues blended with perennial ryegrass. And we find that that makes a great combination for most people in the Central Valley, probably much of Southern California. You get the color of the ryegrass, you get the fine texture of the fine fescue, and it's greater drought tolerance. Fine fescues generally are deeper rooted, and most of them spread out enough. They're not clumpy. They don't form little tight clumps that get thin areas in between them. That was a problem with the other types of fescue. So generally, these make a good combination. There's only one problem with the fine fescues. If you mow them short, they thin out rapidly, especially if you do it right before a hot spell. So if it's going to be in the mid-90s or above, and you cut it below 2 inches, that's about where the growing point is of an individual fine fescue grass plant. I'm the kind of person who's walking across the lawn. This is why I don't golf. And I get 10 feet in, I get down on my knees, and I'm looking at the grass and pulling out the different types. Look at this, guys. This is bent grass. They actually have bent grass. Don, we're actually trying to make progress here. No, but look, they actually have bluegrass over here. The fine fescues in that situation are easy to recognize. They're round bladed. And if you pull them out, you'll see that the growing point where the new blades are coming from is about 2, 2.5 inches up on the plant. So if you mow that short and it's low humidity and high temperature, that growing point of that particular plant will wither and die. You have thousands of these plants in your lawn, so if only 1% of them wither and die, you won't even notice. But if you do it before it gets 95, 100, 105 degrees, very low humidity, maybe 50% of them will wither and die. That won't be good. Your whole lawn will look very rough. The other thing about fescues is they have a fibrous blade, and so if you mow them and your mower isn't sharp, it shreds it instead of cutting it clean.
You've got a fringe lawn.
It looks singed. Your fringed lawn looks singed when you do that, because it then dries and you get this funny appearance. I mean, I've actually pulled the grass out and said, see, this half inch up here is all just withered because it just got shredded by your lawnmower. So sharpen your lawnmower. That's important. Have that done professionally or do it yourself if you know how to do it. But don't mow in extreme heat and don't mow when the humidity is very low.
And mow 3 inches instead of two.
If you possibly can. And it's surprising how often it's difficult to set your mower up high enough for this. I know listeners out there have done this. If you can adopt a 3-inch mower height, your lawn will be a lot better. And also let things come in that are okay that blend with your turf. If you look at the city's park lawns, aside from the Bermuda grass, which you better make a decision about that if it shows up. But if clover shows up in your lawn, fine. Clover is great. Clover feeds the grass. It's a perfectly acceptable blend. If you need a picture perfect lawn, you can do that. If your homeowners association insists on it or something like that. But if your lawn is more for function, get different types of grass in there. Do the fine fescues. Do these new perennial ryegrasses that are darker green and slower growing. Keep seeding them in to get the sufficient density to keep the weeds out. Mow them as high as you can in the summer. And most especially, don't mow short right before high temperatures. That'll take care of most of your brown spots in the lawn problem. There are diseases you occasionally get, anthracnose blight, fusarium blight, but these are more problems with bluegrass than anything else. I've seen them on ryegrass and even occasionally on a type of fescue, but they just don't typically happen the way they used to happen all the time on turf back when people were predominantly bluegrass. The other things you'll sometimes get are sod webworm, which is a caterpillar that feeds on the grass blade. All right, so that's pretty easy to recognize. If you bring a sample in, I'll show you the chew marks. They're not common, but we do have them occasionally, and there are even beneficial nematodes that'll take care of that, or BT. I mean, there are safe sprays for that problem if you want to do that. Grubs are the one people think are a big problem. And in the days of bluegrass lawns, grubs could be. Grubs are beetle larvae, those little white puffy larvae that you find in your vegetable garden. Well, there's a type of those that feed on grass roots. Every year or so, I'll get a customer who's having a big problem with that in their lawn for no apparent reason. They've never had it before, but suddenly the lawn is thinning out. They pull it back and there's all these grubs in there. So for some reason, that beetle decided to oviposit in that area. Usually they run their course. Birds will often take care of them, honestly. I remember seeing an amusing study about how aerating your lawn often killed a lot of the grubs just by puncturing them, because the aerator would literally kill them. They're right there up in the top 2 to 3 inches of soil. So long as your aerator is pushing down that far, it might take care of it. More to the point, they typically run their course and they don't usually come back in the same spot. I don't know really why you had that outbreak, but I'm guessing it probably won't happen again. Just be aware of it, monitor for it next year if that does happen. And there are treatments for grubs, but in general, they're just not a big problem for us here.
Scrub jays, that's the best treatment for grubs.
Well, actually,
if you peel back your lawn to see if they're there, leave it open for a couple of hours. The scrub jays will come in and have a feast.
Absolutely. You know? And that was an easy one to diagnose for people. I mean, if they had a bluegrass, ryegrass lawn that still looked like sod, the way they damage the lawns, they're feeding on the roots. And so you'd walk over to the area that's looking a little dry and grip the turf and pull it up, and it would pull back as if it was sod. And there would be like every 3 inches, one of these fat, pillowy little grubs down there. Pretty easy to diagnose and show the customer what the problem was. There were chemicals used for that in the old days, but I think a lot of lawns now probably have grubs, but they're fescue, so they're deeper rooted, so you probably aren't even seeing the damage. I certainly don't get anywhere near as many calls with concerns about grubs and turf as I used to get. That's something to be aware of. And then my favorite one was when an older customer many years ago, she was probably close to 90, called and said, "Don, you have to come out. My lawn is disappearing." I thought, oh, sure, your lawn's disappearing. Yeah, right. Okay, all right, I'll come on out there. And I went and looked at it. Very nice lady, but her vision wasn't that great. You know what? Her lawn was disappearing. It was literally disappearing. She was absolutely right. And I, what had been a lawn, we were going to her house periodically for various service calls, was just like half gone. And I got down on my knees and I started poking around. And there, every 3 to 4 inches, was a cutworm. Cutworms and army worms are caterpillars of noctuid moths. You leave your window open at night, big fat moth flies in, not a sphinx moth, not that big. That's a noctuid. And their larvae are cutworms and army worms. And I remember learning years ago from one professor, the way to tell them apart is easy. They look exactly the same, but if you poke a cutworm, it curls up. If you poke an army worm, it crawls away. Other than that, they basically look the same and they do the same kind of damage. They feed very heavily on foliage. And over the years, after this interaction with her, I had every now and then, every few years, some customer would get this huge outbreak of cutworm or army worm on their lawn. I mean, it would just devegetate it completely. Good news, they're caterpillars, and caterpillars are pretty easy to control with an organic spray called BT. Cutworms and army worms can occasionally be a problem on turf. They're really obvious once you know what to look for, but they're down just under the top part of the grass. They're just at the ground level. So you have to pull things away, pull them back a little bit. There they are. There are organic treatments available. Spinosad is one. BT is another one.
Well, Don sometimes sends me pictures. Thank you, Don. This picture is marvelous. Mm-hmm. So what I'm looking at, I would say I'm looking at a naked lady, but it's the wrong time of year, isn't it?
It's an amaryllis belladonna, which goes by the common name of naked lady, and they're blooming. And I
early.
Yes, indeed. I try to go out on these types of things, lilacs, things like that, that have a particular season, and take a picture the first day of the bloom so that I can go back year to year and see. And yes, this is a full week ahead of last year when I took this picture. Usually it's late July that Lois and I are talking about how there's naked ladies out in the garden. I woke it out of my yard. There's some naked ladies out there, Lois. Amaryllis belladonna, and it blooms. The name comes from the fact that it grows through the winter and the spring. The leaves die down completely, and then 2-3 months later, completely out of the blue, up pop these long, bare, naked stems with pink flowers at the top. There's a white version out there. There's shades of pink, but predominantly Amaryllis belladonna is a nice light to medium pink. Blooms like crazy. The plants I'm looking at are from bulbs that were given to me 40 years ago by my mother, who had gotten them from her father. It's that kind of a plant, over the fence plant. They are extremely easy to grow in California. They have naturalized to some degree in the Mendocino area and other coastal zones because it doesn't, the climate is so mild that they don't even need irrigation during the summertime there. Here, they really don't need that much. When she gave us this bag of bulbs, we scattered them all over the property and planted them in different places. Mostly full sun when we planted them. Some of them are in complete and total shade, still bloom. Some of them are places where they get irrigated. It's part of the garden. This one is an area where there's plants nearby getting irrigated. Others are in places where they haven't been directly irrigated for years. They get natural rainfall, and that's about it. There's probably a drip line nearby they're tapping into a little bit, but not much. And they do fine. They are just finally getting crowded after 40 years to the point that I might thin them out a little bit. Other than that, indestructible plant, great California plant, not a native, but to me, when I see amaryllis growing somewhere, I know there was probably a house or home there once.
Today's quote is, trees could solve the problem if people trying to improve things would only allow them to take over.
You've been listening to The Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.